to further my debate on this subject. And then I want to talk about some multiple effects that can happen. So I'm going to try to attempt to present a model of hyperinflation where I can get some interesting non-Gaussian signal from adding more than one field. And in that particular, this is the stack-young mediated mediator mechanism. And I'll show deterministic inflation as an example of how to achieve the signal. So this is the overall theme, but just first the general philosophy and the phone. I don't want to be recorded for this. Okay, so the general philosophy, I like to think that to start with what has been, we didn't have the LHC, so for many years we're doing electroweak crystalline tests. For example, my favorite diagram in all of physics is the Gary triangle. And so we're measuring very precisely what these angles were. And while, measuring the CKM matrices, and we're learning things about the physics of the CEB scale by doing physics really at the, GEB scale, like Zoe boson. And while with this type of methods, you cannot really discover, you cannot say for sure whether supersymmetry is there or not. You can discover it with constraint. You can learn things about physics at a higher scale than the physics that you're doing just by doing some precision tests. And like the flavor changing neutral currents is, a good story here. And since here we're doing the same idea, but now we're moving up in the scale and we're looking at Gott inflation or alternatives to it. And we're trying, the question is, can we find some cosmological precision tests, with the S model we should put there, that would tell us, give us some intuition or tell us some stuff about the Planck scale or the Planck ceiling. And for cosmologists, this is really hard to do if you're doing physics at the LHE, the Planck scale is way up there, and you never see it. It's a very small effect. But cosmologists are banging their head literally all the time at the Planck ceiling, and they write theories which often don't make that really seems to require some kind of UV completion. And so there's two goals. One is to use cosmology to learn about quantum gravity. That's my, one of the first goals. And the idea again is to understand a very high scale phenomena. And so can we look at quantum gravity direction, in particular if you're interested in string theory, can we find some stringy signature, some signals that will definitely look like physics beyond the standard model that we can reproduce with string theory, but that are not easy to reproduce, say, quantum field theory. That would be, the Holy Grail, something that would be really interesting to find. And right now it seems like one of the key quantities to look at are like the UV sensitive quality, like non-Gaussianity, tensor modes, the special properties of cosmic string could be another. So there's different windows, and this is far from complete, and the idea is to look for different things you can search for that will maybe teach you things about the Planck scale. And in this talk, I'll be talking about some multi-field setup that will generate some non-Gaussianity. And the sort of conclusion is will be that it's kind of tricky from the string theory point of view. And this is related to talks we've heard here about this multi-field and non-Gaussianity. The other approach is to use particle physics, string theory thinking to learn things about cosmology. So cosmology is not the same thing as particle physics, as they actually do things differently. And in particular, in particle physics, we're used to send some in-state, which we have a lot of control with, send it, there's some interaction, and then we have an out-state, which we also have a lot of control with. So the in-state will be, say, proton and the LHC, and the out-state will be a bunch of particles, all of which are free, and like muons and so forth, and we're just collecting. And so this is a scattering amplitude, this is what you're trying, the S matrix, that's where you're trying to calculate, in particle physics. In cosmology, and then similarly in some condensed matter system, what you're calculating are expectation values, which are actually a function of time. So you start with some in state, you evolve it to some time t, and then you go back to your in state and you just evaluate this correlation function as a function of time. So this there's no time dependence here versus here, there's going to be an explicit time dependence in the things that we're calculating. And while there's been a lot of paper, this has been known for a long time, this is the so-called Kelder-Schwinger mechanism to calculate these kind of correlation functions in quantum field theory. There's been a lot of renewal of interest in these kind of, to just formally define these kind of calculations. In particular, people are starting to start calculate quantum contribution to the correlation function that cosmologists are calculating. And there's this notion of effective field theory for inflation is still something that people are, you know, really starting to discuss. What is it? All should we think about effective field theory when we're doing inflation? So the summary of my result of my talk essentially is that there is some hint in the data. I'm not particularly controlling at W mat 5. There's some hint that it could be some non-Gaussianity. This is FNL. I'm going to describe this again. It's the hint is that you see here, 0 is not excluded, but it looks like the median is more like in the middle, around 50. So there's some hint of non-Gaussianity with a local shape, at least if we really believe this result, exactly. And the question is, can we reproduce this using some string theory model? And so I proposed a method to reproduce a signal, which I believe is the sort of one of the most natural way, the simplest way to potentially get it. And the string method will be that's far from generic. And if I just take these string theory models that people have been working with, I don't get non-Gaussianity at this time. So it's slightly a negative result. So it's not like string theory predicts something like this, at least at this point. Really, of course, yeah, really not what's going on. But there's also going to be a cosmology lesson. And this is still a work in progress, and that we found that in some cases of parameter space, we can have our three-point function be dominated by what I would call loop contributions, as I will define it. And this is still a work in progress, but it's getting looks like it should be right. So just to review for some of all the everybody here already knows this, but just I want to make the main point of what I want you to remember about inflation in case you're not a cosmologist. So the idea of inflation, say you can start with a smooth patch. This is a very contrived initial condition. But let's say you start with a very smooth patch of dark energy, which you can model by a scalar field. It has some size, and it's impressive that we can tell it's not smaller than a certain number. Because if it would be smaller, then the energy scale would be higher, and we would have already seen the tensor mode. And we haven't seen the tensor mode, so at least in this framework, we know that this little smooth patch is very small, but not so small. And this is just incredible. Again, this is just incredible that cosmology is able to tell us information about scales in this range. And this is not so far from the Planck scale, so this is why string theorists should be interested about cosmology. So if I just have this little patch and inflates, the horizon can remain constant and fades and means the universe become huge. And I didn't know it was outside of my original patch, and I don't care at this point. But so in place, I have my horizon, nothing go out of it. And the main point, and I won't go through the history of the whole universe, I'll stop right here for my talk, is that I'm generating quantum fluctuation in the curvature of space-time, whose amplitudes are all the same, but whose wavelengths are stretched by the expansion. And the amplitude is essentially fixed by the size of the horizon, which remains roughly constant during inflation. And one of the main points which I'm going to play with is normally in single field model, these curvature perturbations, which all have, all have the same amplitude. So this is the scalar invariant spectrum of perturbations. And so all these guys, in single field model, they will normally be, the amplitude will be fixed. As soon as they are, their wavelength is greater than the size of the horizon. But if you have more than one field, you can change the curvature perturbation after the exit of the horizon. Okay? So this is the model of inflation, and in string theory, we want to model this. Is there a way that this, so this is a nice little paradigm, but we want to model to work with it. One of the most popular models is brain inflation, which says that you have essentially two brains that move close to each other. They flattened out just because of inflation, so just all the first and immunities are gone. Then you have a graceful exit where these things bang into each other, and that's when the tachyon condensation kicks in. This is also my graceful exit here. So this is, and this is what I'm going to, the tachyon condensation is going to be important for my talk, is what I want to use to see if I can generate the non-Gaussianity. So this is a nice idea, and there's been a lot of work to actually realize this kind of model in string theory. And these work, that's been, mildly successful, depending on your opinion. It's not that easy to make inflation work, but it can work. And the tachyon condensation, so this is how inflation ends in these models, is that you have the two brains annihilate, and this is normally a very stringy phenomenon. The tachyon condensation and the annihilation. There is an effective field theory description for it that Sen proposed, and there's some boundary string field theory also description, or open string field theory But the point is, normally, this is a very stringy phenomenon. It can have some special consequences for reeating, and there's a lot of work here. I'm not citing because I won't be discussing this. But there's a lot of very interesting physics here that's going on. It would be very interesting if you could observe the end of inflation, because in this model, it's somewhat special. In particular, one also one of the things you get from that brain inflation is you get these metastable two-dimensional two defects, which are essentially cosmic spin, which can have special properties which could be observable. So this is an interesting phenomenon. In this talk, I would like to discuss whether it's possible to generate density perturbations with some non-Gaussian spectrum at the end when the tachyon condenses. And so there's a long history of trying to do this kind of thing. And going beyond the single field model, which predicts no non-Gaussian entity, to go to multi-field. And this is an incomplete reference, it's obviously an incomplete history as well, but just to summarize a little bit, what's happening is, like I already hinted at, in multi-field inflation, the curvature perturbation, which I did not see, is not necessarily constant after arriving, it can change. So the simplest thing to do, in general, is going to be really complicated. You will have some complicated trajectory in field space, you have many fields. You have some complicated trajectory, and you should integrate over the whole trajectory and figure out what your curvature perturbation is. The simplest thing to do often is just to suppose that if there's going to be any change in the curvature perturbation, it's all going to be localized at one point in time. Okay, so I'm going to assume that indeed the curvature perturbation changes, but it changes when some special event occurs, and that's it. And there's three types of model in particular that proposed under this slide. I'm going to discuss the last one, but the curvaton model is when you have a new field that starts dominating the energy density and after the end of inflation in your hands. And there's some analog of this in the ekparotic model that's been discussed.
But is your second field light during inflation?
Yeah, it should be. Yeah,
because I always thought of this, the way to think of this two field is it's more like a hybrid model where it's heavy and then it becomes tachyonic at the end.
I'm going to explain my model, but the tachyon is not my second field.
Oh, okay.
The tachyon is going to be my messenger. The tachyon is what sets when I'm transferring my isocurvature into curvature. But yes, the tachyon is indeed very massive during inflation, and it's not going to be the one that's going to generate changes in curvature perturbation.
So, is there a difference between the first and second, the counterpart and modulated frequency?
Well, not really, and neither between the second and the third.
Is that all modulated frequency?
Yeah, so it's just different time. You know, is it way after the end of inflation, while you're reheating, or just before you start reheating? But really, it's all, and in fact, you could have all three together at the same time. So, it's not much difference. But you need to still decide a time, and I'm going to take the modulated end of inflation, which is a scenario that life has been much involved with, which is essentially saying that the onset of reheating is modulated, but then it proceeds everywhere at the same rate and at the same in sync. And I have nothing else coming out later, and it could be a curvaton model in addition to everything that I'm saying. I'm just going to simplify as much as I can by looking in this scenario. Right. So this is, I've learned a lot from other people now. This is interdisciplinary. So I have Alice here, coming in with Bob. So Alice is my evidence actor. So this is the particle physics. This is how I used to call it. Now I'm going to call it Alice and Bob. So I have a hidden sector, which is a field, which I suppose is not very massive, therefore fluctuating during inflation. So Alice is fluctuating. She's fluctuating. And then I'm going to transfer the fluctuation of Alice to Bob with the tachyon. Okay, and so this is, and the tachyon here, the end again, as you were saying, Gus, it's very massive during inflation, but then you reach a certain critical value of the amplitude where you fall down your potential, and then inflation ends suddenly. I'm taking this end point to be very sudden, and then I'm just transferring the isocurvature perturbation in this hidden field to my visible sector, which is my amplitude curvature. So the tachyon itself is not what's generating the density perturbation, it's just what's transferring one to the other. And if I was to take the tachyon to zero, or suppose that I have no tachyon, then these two sectors will be decoupled. So this is, I'm repeating again, so now you've seen it in words, and you've seen it in picture, and now it's just some equations. So the simple model here is to take a hybrid model where I have potential for phi, a potential for my hidden sector chi, and then some messenger sector where I'm talking these three fields all back to each other. So if I set the tachyon to zero, which is where this bev is during inflation while you're inflating, then this just vanishes and these two fields all talk to each other. And then the simplification is to assume that, yes, during inflation, you have some dynamical solution for phi, chi set at zero, t set at zero, and then the upper scale depends on the inflaton field only. Okay, so the energy density only sensitive to phi. And then where the field chi comes in is just in determining where inflation ends. Okay, so I have my massive, my tachyon field is a function of phi and chi, and then I have some critical value of chi, of phi, when inflation ends, but that's a function. Okay. So this is a simpler system that is a multi-field and that can generate density perturbation, and that sort of can occur somewhat naturally, like you think at first, but just to occur naturally in the string theory model, because in string theory model, per screen brain inflation, you always have this sort of tachyon. It's very often.
So chi is light during inflation?
Yes.
And t is heavy. And T is heavy.
T is heavy, yes, that's right. So during inflation, T is set to zero, and then... Okay? And then, yeah, so then when you have this modulated N of inflation, what this does really, and the quick thing about this is I'm inflating, so I have my FRW scale factor, and I can have some curvature perturbation to it. And so when inflating, so like I said, so if you go from horizon crossing, which I call T star, to the final time, the scale factor has grown by e to the number of V fold. And you can see that if different point in space inflate for a different amount of time and have therefore a different amount of V folds, you're directly generating a curvature perturbation. So yeah, so this is the usual idea that a curvature perturbation can be seen as a perturbation of the number of V-fold. And this is sort of called delta N formalism, but it's not that deep. So I'm using, usually what you do is using your in formalism to calculate the correlation function for your 2 or your 3 point up to a certain time t. And then you use classical evolution, which is this delta N, which to further evolve your curvature perturbation. And when you do that, your curvature perturbation ends up just being equal to the variation of the number of V-fold. As you vary your fields. Okay. And this cosangle field reproduced in a well-known result. If I have my number of V-fold is written as the integral from phi star to phi critical of h dt, which is what this is, then you get that you're just varying the number of V-fold with phi going to phi plus delta phi, you get that delta n, you get the curvature perturbation, which is just minus h of phi delta. So there's a direct relation between the variation in the inflaton field and the variation in the curvaton. And this is all evaluated at the rising crossing. So it's coming from the lower bound of the interval. Okay, so this is a method, and this is really valid only starting at the rising crossing going forward. For this part here, you should use the actual. You should, well, for the two-point function, you only need to use the classical equation of motions. But if you want to calculate 3-point or 4-point, you should really use the interaction of Hamiltonian, calculate this, you know, using Feynman diagram, but not in usual scattering amplitude way. You should do it Feynman diagram and just in theory. But this is for the 3 or 4-point. If you just want to keep the 2-point function, there's just classical evolution here and classical evolution in the usual way. All right, so if you do this for my theory, which again is very simple, the only place where this field chi comes in is in this upper bound of my integral. So the critical value depends on chi. This h here is only a function of phi. So I'm assuming that all my energy is dominated by the inflaton field, the potential for the inflaton. And the only thing chi does is determines where my inflation is. And so when you do this expansion, you get multiple terms. You get this usual contribution from the inflaton, and you get this extra contribution from chi, where this you get this derivative, del phi critical d chi, and I call that my transfer function. So this sort of measures how much you transfer a perturbation delta chi is transferred into a perturbation in the curvature. Okay. So in other words, if delta chi fluctuates in some way, it tells you how much fluctuation in chi convert into a fluctuation of phi. Okay. And then you have some nonlinear terms. There's also some nonlinear term with delta phi squared, but I just dropped down, these are the most important term. And I subtracted a number so to make the one-point function vanished. Okay. And this sign difference is just because one is coming from the lower bound and the other one is coming from the upper bound. And this is evaluated at the end of the equation. And this is important, and this is the reason why it's not, most models are not going to work, is that this contribution from the tachyons, obviously, could have, you know, predicted from the very beginning, are coming, all coming from the end of inflation. And at the end of inflation, the potential tends to be steeper. And that's going to be a problem, as we'll see. Okay, so now that I have this, I can calculate the two-point function. And, you know, delta phi, delta chi. Again, this technically you should really evaluate. I'm assuming one thing here, that delta phi and delta chi don't talk to each other inside of the horizon. So they don't have direct coupling. If they don't, then you get this simple relation. And this kappa, which is not really important, is because, again, delta chi, I need to evaluate this at the end of inflation. When I do that, I get a damping, because this guy is damped because of its classical evolution. So there's a damping, which usually you can set to 1, but you can be careful and keep them too. Okay, so when you do this, you get the two-point function. So this is just delta n squared calculated. The epsilon is the spherical parameter, which is v prime over v, or is also my h over phi dot. This is really just the variation. You can see, be seen as a variation of h over h. And so you get this two-point function, and you get this extra term. This is the new term coming from my tachyon stuff. And this, so gamma has to be less than 1. This is, you can show that this is true in general. Otherwise, I need to recalculate. But from any model, you can show that gamma has to be less than 1. Otherwise, it's outside of your validity, original validity of your theory. So gamma should be less than 1. Kappa is damping. It's always less than 1. And the key point is that in most models, the potential gets steeper as you get towards the end. And so epsilon, which is measured at the slope, it's v prime over v, gets larger as you get towards the end of inflation. And so this contribution in general is always smaller than this one. It's pretty tricky to make this bigger than this. There's one proposal, I have it here, that's allowed in a nice proposed potential, which is essentially just delta potential, which is sort of just goes like this, where at the beginning it's pretty steep, and at the end it smooths out, and then I guess you have some magnification, you're gonna have a tachyon kicking in somewhere. So yes, you can write down some potential where the contribution coming from the end would be more important than from the beginning. Say the beginning is here, and this is your endpoint. So this will be the 55 default. So epsilon star, and again epsilon v prime over v squared. So you could be that the slope is bigger at the beginning than at the end. So this would be a system where this third would be more important. But in general, you don't usually have a hill of potential. Usually epsilon increases. And essentially think of it as epsilon, you're tuning this parameter to be small. If you're tuning it to be small at some point for horizon crossing, there's no reason it's going to be small also at the end. So it's a further tuning.
I think that's true, because actually you have to fine tune epsilon for it to become small. Usually,
it becomes small at the end.
So the thing is that to make epsilon large at the end, you have to make the vacuum zero. The minimum must be at zero. If you have a finite, then epsilon becomes zero basically at the end, right? Because you see that the minimum, and epsilon b prime is zero. So if you have a second field that could end the inflation, then you don't really need epsilon to go to 1 because you go.
Right. Well, that's true. You shouldn't get exactly to 0. But the point is, if you tune your potential to be flat at some point, it will at some point either get, you know, less flat or flatter at some point. But it's not clear to me that in most models, in epsilon, it ends up not being as flat at the end when it is at the beginning. I mean, I agree if it doesn't have to be 1, Hershey, you had Ivy.
But you can actually, V' becomes the smaller because you got the minimum of the potential, but the minimum potential isn't at zero. So that epsilon goes to zero. So that's, again, the argument and debate is that naturally epsilon goes to zero. Unless you find things so the minimum is at zero. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because V' goes to zero, but V goes to finite.
Right, but yes.
Sorry, you'd normally say epsilon has to get large.
But that's right. Because you have one field. You have two fields, if you have another field that tends to inflation, there is no reason for epsilon to be large. You could go to a very small epsilon and then the second field sticks in alpha.
No, I guess, yeah, it is a good point. I think in the model with the fire, then usually the epsilon, in gray inflation in particular, the potential gets steeper as you move forward. And yes, I guess if you really have until the end, at some point it has to come to zero just to follow out. I mean, usually it's just you get it to, you sort of, it's a continuous slope into the attacking condensation and to the attacking direction. So it's not necessarily, I mean, there's a saddle point. Okay, so, right, so then non-Gaussianity, I'm going to go quickly. So now I just calculate the 2-point, now we can get a 3-point function also from this. And, but this is just, again, so I'm just going to use this multi-field, and I'm going to propose that the D-term inflation can realize this non-Gaussianity at this time. And I'm looking at the local non-Gaussianity with this time with NZAS for curvature. Okay? So there's two contributions to the non-Gaussianity, and they were sort of both known, just we and our paper were putting them sort of together in a more general context. So first of all, this field is not my inflaton, so in general, it can have this deep potential. It doesn't have, it has to have a mass which is lower than h in order for it to fluctuate, but it doesn't have to be as flat a potential as you need for the inflaton, because you're not actually failing in this field. So in general, it can have what I call an intrinsic contribution to FNL, which is just directly calculate this 3-point function. And then you take calculate this and then just transfer it to the curvature. So this has been done before for this kind of field. I'm assuming if you assume a canonical kinetic term, you get that you get a shape which is you get a bispectral, which is that free derivative of the potential d prime 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 here, so it's just function of potential, and the shape in the momentum space is still called a local shape, which is what gives you this FNL hands axis. And there's two things to know. Well, first it grows as a number of b-fold. This is, I guess, again well known. But when you transfer it to the FNL intrinsic, you get again this ratio of epsilon between epsilon star and epsilon f. And so again, if you don't have the same ratio, you can in general get something that it reduces the effect of the element version. And then there's another contribution, which is a nonlinear contribution, which is from these terms I wrote down before. And so this is just, now if I take the square or the cube of that, capture the 2-point function, I'm going to get terms which mixes these nonlinear terms with other terms. And you can calculate this, and it's just a function. Again, you have this ratio of epsilon, but you also, the only difference here is you get this derivative of your transfer function. Okay, so there's two contributions, both of which have exactly the same shape. To the local shape, but they can have different signs. And in general, you can calculate which one is bigger between these two things. And you can do this in pure generality. This is the answer. Because they have exactly the same shape, they really can just add both of them together. And for the general case of, say, you take the transfer function to be a linear function, you can show that this nonlinear piece here is always bigger than the intrinsic piece. In other words, this beta number here is less than 1. Yeah. But still, sometimes you can have, in the model I'll show at the end, you can have this intrinsic piece to be a significant fraction. It's always less than local, but it could be significant, because this number, while it's less than 1, it's not always much less than 1. So the loop effect I was talking about. I'm going to go quickly here, but the idea is if I look at my curvature perturbation, I have this nonlinear piece here, and if I just calculate the 2-point function, I will get a piece which is the square of this. So I just square this amplitude. I will get a piece which, for example, would go just like this term times this term. and this is a two-point function. But I'm left, it's not just a two-point function, I'm left with an integral over the momentum. And this is really should be interpreted as a loop, although it's sort of the classical evolution of a loop. So it's kind of weird because I'm using delta n from algebra. So I'm not getting the UV behavior. The only thing I'm getting is the IR of the loop. This formalism only worked from the time of horizon crossing forward. But nevertheless, you always get this contribution, which goes like log of KL, which is the IR divergent, where L is some cutoff. And you can show that, well, so you always can get this, you can show that these contributions can dominate over this piece alone, the delta chi squared. It doesn't dominate over this, because if it would dominate over delta pi squared, then perturbation theory would break down. But you can show that this contribution is bigger than this one to the two-point function in some region of Hamilton space. And the trick to do this is to take the transfer function, gamma prime to be a lot bigger than gamma. Okay. And you can make this theory truncate by, for example, having a function that goes to zero. Gamma transfer gamma prime is zero. So I can truncate the series, and everything is convergent and nice. And so for the two-point, this is still not so interesting, but for the three-point, if this dominates over this for the three-point, then that means your two-point function is dominated by loops. And there's a lot of interesting question about infrared divergences in inflation. You know, what is exactly is this L, for example? If I take the L to be the size of the universe today, or if I take this IR cutoff to be the size of the universe at recombination, then I will change my answer to my normal sampling diet after a log 3. Just a log, but so it's interesting that you get this setup which seems like it could be dominated by these loop contributions. But so this is the working progress. Okay, so now this is a general procedure. So there's this hint in the data that we can get some non-local FNL, some local non-Gaussian entity. And can we really generate this in string theory? So the brain inflation, the most like up-to-date model, which is from the Princeton group, has some kind of saddle point potential. And the potential is usually tuned to be really flat at some point in the multiply space, but it's not very tuned elsewhere. It actually probably goes to 1 even before you reach the tachyon. So even though this model has a tachyon in it, it doesn't, you actually cannot use this method. Okay? And there's two problems actually, and this group have been analyzing very much in detail whether you could get any signal from the elementation in this model. And they found two problems. One is that there's actually no light fields, and these light fields would come from isometries and the potential, which depends on the D7 Brainard reading. So it's somewhat of a technical issue, but it turns out there's no light direction near the tip.
So just one thing is a model of what D7 and D3 is in the conical?
This model is a D3 and an anti D3 in the conical with some D7 Brainard embedding. Right. So this is far from the tip.
Oh, okay.
Where do you get this potential to work out?
Yeah.
So these guys have analyzed the potential near the tip, which requires to do a different analysis because the tip is different work factor. And they found that there's no effect. So they look exactly for that kind of tachyon condensation related, tachyon mediated non-Gaussianity. And they found that there was no effect, although it was somewhat effective. And indeed, they were pointing out that epsilon is bigger, sorry, smaller than you might expect from what the argument I'm making here. But still, they didn't find anything. So let's look at another example, which is determinflation. And I think I have like 5 minutes. Sorry, making it. Yeah, I should. I'll go fast, sorry. So if you do D-term inflation, and I'll just show you the potential. So D-term inflation has a potential, and I'm just going to take a simplest example, which is a Coleman-Weinberg potential. And this is a hybrid model, where inflation ends at some point, and you have a tachyon. And there's two regimes. And one of it is NS, say, is 0.98. The potential is lifted up at some high value, 10 minus 5, so it's very pretty high. And you produce cosmic string, because you have some U1 breaking, and these cosmic strings are very heavy, so they need to be unstable, because otherwise we would have seen these. And there's a second regime where S is close to the critical value, where NS is over 1, in which case you consume the Kessel string to be smaller. And at first it seems like this should be more fine-tuned because this is sort of a flatter potential than this one. And I think, I mean, fine-tuning the issue between these two regimes is just one where you sort of trade off between fine-tuning dimensionless variable versus fine-tuning initial conditions. So I wouldn't say which one is more fine-tuned than the other. They're just two regimes and you get different answers. So if you just try these two things, the Zeigarnik model, and you ask yourself which one will produce the FNL I want, this one is pretty hard to get the FNL, large FNL, which is this one you can. And again, this is because just the potential stack for this one. So you just remain epsilon star and epsilon f essentially are exactly equal to each other. But of course, so this is, of course, the problem is this is n is equal to 1. So how do you explain this? And we were not too happy with it, but some people say that you could have a flat spectrum if you use a constant string. So there's this claim that if you fit the WMAP data with constant string, that n s equal 1 is not as ruled out as you think it is. And so these people have claimed this. Alternatively, you could just say n s equal 1 is not favored, but it's not either.
So what is the FNL like you get from
me? So the FNL you get is you can get different FNL. Well, here I'm showing exactly the model, because the model, but you can get like 25 or 30 cents.
NS is
1. Yeah, NS is 1. So let me go back again. But so you can realize model string theory, and I'm running out of time, where NS is 1, you have cosmic string, and we have this, you can do it, the D3D7 is somewhat more known here in a particular cliff, here's been working on it, which is sort of a realization of D term. And in general, you can set up the system so that it works, and we have our own way of doing it. But yeah, it's a somewhat contrived region of parameter space. And so we found it that it was kind of hard to get these FNL to work out. And in the general conclusion, which is true of almost of every brain function model I've looked at, is that we always have this transfer function proportional to chi, and we're able to find some point which, you know, could give us dark on the sanity, but we needed to go to these NS equal 1. Okay, so to conclude, we can have a general consortium of large Noether sanity with rich structure in the sense that there's many things that can contribute to it, like the intrinsic, the local, the or the loop effect. We found that it's possible to generate, you know, to get it to work, but the one model we found is D-term inflation with cosmic string. But this is like, this is somewhat of a weird model in the sense that it's not the typical model you expect. So that's why it's slightly a negative conclusion from the string theory side. But there's further question like the loop effects, which is still work in progress. What does it mean? It can be something observable coming from these kind of things, like a running, for example, or could it be something about the 4-point that would be interesting, which we haven't looked at. And also in this model, we have large contribution from cosmic string. And so the Noether sanity might have an additional contribution than the one I wrote down coming from the cosmic string, which I did not include in this. Yeah, thank you.
So what is the geometric meaning of chi in the string model?
So the simplest thing would be that in brain inflation, it would be some angular direction, some isometric, approximately isometric direction. So you want something that's pretty much flat, and that couples to the tachyon. So the tachyon is the mass of the tachyon is going to be a function of the distance between the two brains. Say it's D3D7, it's going to be a function of the two brains. And so even though you might be moving in some radial direction, say in the conifold, and you might have some approximate angular direction, you know, say for example, near the tip, you have an S3, you have a couple of angles there. It's approximately, you know, there are isometries, so the mass should be low. So if your brain is slightly off, if you're perturbing and your brain is slightly off from the S3, that will change the mass of the tachyon, it will change when inflation ends. So this is where, and this is, for example, in the D3 and TD3 of the Bowman et al. Paper. It turns out that for the particular D7 brain embedding they chose, there was no isometry left at the bottom. The D7 brain embedding was breaking every single one of the S2. It was just filling it. So in that case, that was one more reason why I didn't find any signal. But that's not clear in general. It's going to be true. Yeah.
In this case, you're showing like a coin on one by potential. What's the model, which is defined, or is it just?
So yeah, so so the model is just a would be like a Dieter model, which the simplest is something like what the original model was proposed by Dimitri Fali and Aliyev, where here you have three fields, S, phi plus, phi minus. And you have this kind of superpotential and this kind of theory potential. This is like really simple. And you can then start working with typing correction to this model.
Yeah, I think confused because you mentioned loop effects. I mean, it's a loop.
That's right, but this is not the same thing here.
Okay.
This is the Coleman library is just because I'm breaking Susie.
Yeah.
But you see, this is typical of this regime, which I'm always confused, because when you calculate correlation function, you're doing one set of calculation. But then when you calculate the potential, and you calculate the Coleman-Weinberg, you're doing another kind of calculation, what I'm used to particle physics. And they're slightly, they're not always the same, so.
I see.
And this is just, but you're right, there's definitely loop here. The loop, I was talking originally to the quantum loops to the correlation function, versus this is also one new calculation. But this is a big factor of potential. And I don't know if they're really related.
I have one question. So, if loops dominate the calculation of the character perturbations, then wouldn't you expect non Gauss energy to be used? Because loops are not Gauss, something like that. These are quadratic.
Well, but not.
No, is that okay? So maybe
I'm not sure.
But I'd say so. Maybe chi is a Gaussian random field,
right.
But your zeta, your curvature is dominated by this delta chi squared. That's what you're saying, right?
So the 2 point is still the loop dominates only in the 3 point because delta phi. So in my 2 point though, I can take my 2 point function for the curvature. The dominant term is delta phi squared, which is perfectly Gaussian, and then I have. Then becomes this loop effect, which is delta chi if you want to the 4, and I integrate. And it's just saying that this term dominates over what I would have usually used to be just delta chi. And but since in the 3-point function, so the bispectrum, I don't have a delta phi invisible there, then I can just drop the delta phi contribution. And then this guy, the bispectrum, is going to be dominated by loops. But still, the 2-point is bigger than the 3-point.
Excellent. Yes. Yeah. So I was wondering for the cosmic string non-Gaussian contribution. I'm just curious. So presumably it's not local in shape.
Presumably not.
But do we have a sense for how, in terms if I parameterize just some how it scales with the function?
This is a big. I've been discussing with the local experts about this. I would like to know the answer. I don't know what exactly the non-Gaussian.
I'm going to say SNL is not a good parameter to.
Most probably. Yeah.
Marsh says it doesn't even have the same scaling. Like the 3-point goes like the 3-point to the 3-hat.
Yeah, right.
Oh, I
see. There's many contribution to the. So I mean, yeah, there's different argument. One of which is, on large scale, you're adding a lot of non-Gaussian things, but the central limit theorem should look something like Gaussian. But then on small scale, you have like kinks, you have loops, right. And maybe there it's going to be non-Gaussian. So that would be just on small scale, therefore it wouldn't be something FNL, it would be something
Yeah, not interesting.
But that's a very interesting question, what is a non-Gaussian acting cross section? I don't think it's been fully solved. I don't know the answer.
Okay, so no further questions. Let's take the speaker again.